This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The music industry is being shaken up by mega mergers and the free distribution of music on the internet. My guest Bill Flanagan has written a new novel about changes in the music industry. It's called A&R. A&R stands for Artisan Repertoire, the business of finding and nurturing talent. The novel looks at the industry through the eyes of a 30-year-old talent scout who leaves an independent record label to become head of A&R at a major conglomerate. Author Bill Flanagan is Senior Vice President and Editorial Director of VH1, where he created the show Storytellers and Legends. He's the former editor of Musician magazine and author of Written in My Soul, a collection of conversations with songwriters, and a book about U2. I asked Flanagan why he made the central character in his new novel an A&R man.
Well, the A&R men are in a terrific position. They're sort of the link between the artist and the record company. They're the people who go out and find the talent, who bring the talent in, and who nurture them along, and supposedly make big hits. Now, if the A&R man has success, that is to say, if the artist he brings in has success, then he can become real rich, real powerful. But the A&R man's only as good as his latest hit or his latest hit artist. And if he doesn't bring in somebody who gets a big hit, the A&R man is out. And as an A&R man who read the book said to me the other day, and there's nowhere to go. The job doesn't prepare you for anything else in life. So it's a pretty dramatic position to be in. And of course, it also, just in terms of kind of making an exciting narrative, he's the person in the hot seat. He's the person who has to sell the label to the artist and the artist to the label. And that's not something that happens once. That happens over and over and over with every record, with every decision, with every argument. He's the man in the middle.
Do you think the role of A&R has changed as the whole record industry has changed?
Oh, it's changed tremendously. The A&R, in fact, the name A&R, Artisan Repertoire, used to mean in the 40s and 50s, kind of exactly what it says. The A&R man would find a song that he thought was going to be a hit. He'd find White Christmas. He'd book a studio. He'd hire the orchestra. He'd hire the arranger. He'd get the sheet music together. And then he'd say, I think this is a good one for Bing Crosby. Let's bring Bing in. And if by any chance Bing didn't pull it off, or the A&R man didn't think it worked well with Bing, he'd say, well, let's try it again with Rosemary Clooney. So the A&R man was very much assembling all the pieces of the puzzle. In the 60s, with the Beatles and Bob Dylan, the old A&R men and the whole old record industry was shoved aside, because now the artists were self-sufficient. They wrote their songs, they produced their own records, they booked the session, they played the instruments themselves. So the A&R man evolved into something different. He became sort of the handholder, or some artists would say the guy with the hand in their pocket, but he became the one who searched the world for the next Beatles, for the next Rolling Stones, for the next Billy Joel. And he became much more of a kind of a the cowboy who rides into town, you know, the guy who walks into the saloon and says, anybody in here want to challenge me to a game of fast draw?
The A&R guy in your novel starts off at an independent record label and is lured to a major label, you know, to a big corporate label through the offer of a bigger salary and a big percentage of profits. What are the problems he faces at this big corporate label that he didn't face at the independent label?
Well, probably what happens to Cantone, who's the kind of idealistic young A&R man, is that he sort of is still innocent enough, naive enough, or good-hearted enough to think that it's all about the music, that it's all about falling in love with a band, falling in love with a singer, and then sharing that with the world. And I think what he comes up against at the major label, he probably would have come up against at some point, wherever he was. And that's the fact that when millions of dollars are riding on it, it is big business, and there's no way to avoid becoming a businessman. And the thing that he wrestles with through the whole novel is how far he'll compromise himself. I think it's something that people have to face in every job. You know, I picked the music business in the record business because it's something I know very well, and because these things are kind of in bold relief there. But to tell you the truth, I think the book could have been set in almost any sort of business, because people do face these things. They do come in thinking of themselves as idealistic and in it for the best reasons, and very often they find as they go along that they've compromised more than they ever meant to.
One character in the novel describes the record industry as playing a game of moral jujitsu, where standing up for doing the right thing gets flipped around to become evidence of selfishness. What does he mean?
That's a scene I really like, because it's a scene I think it plays out in all kinds of places a lot. There's a scene where Cantone, the idealistic A&R man, gets a tape in the mail, by a folk singer named Paul Slocum. This is someone who's maybe 50 years old, has never had a hit, but is really, really good. And Cantone listens to it over and over and says, boy, I know that this is not going to succeed in an NSYNC Britney Spears world, but it's such a good record. There's such good songs. He goes to his boss and says, JB, look, I'm not going to tell you that this is going to sell millions of records, but we make so much money on all these other acts anyway. Couldn't we put this one out just because it's good music, just because it's beautiful? Surely we could afford to do that one time. And his boss looks at him and says, Jim, I never knew you could be so selfish. And goes on to explain that to try and impose his own taste on the public who do not share that taste is an act of selfishness. Basically, Booth says, go ahead, you know, take this guy's tapes home, listen to him all you want, but when you come to work, your job is to serve the public, and anything else is just self-indulgence. And Jim comes out sort of shaken because he was prepared for all kinds of financial or commercial arguments, but he wasn't prepared to be told that doing something for altruistic reasons meant that he had to be selfish. And he describes moral jujitsu as taking anything that's done for the right intentions and saying that it's evidence of elitism or selfishness or whatever else you want to do. And I think it happens an awful lot. And, you know, I think there's a little bit of that. I think, like everyone, I'm awful glad that I'm glad communism fell. I'm glad that Europe is free. I'm happy to see prosperity as much as the next guy. But I do think that it's kind of like, ideologically, the other guy jumped off the seesaw and we went flying through the air. Then there's a kind of a real hardcore notion afoot right now that if it makes money, it's good. And it's not just good financially, it's good in every way. It's morally good, it's ethically good. We're into some kind of super high Protestant 1902 mentality that seems to have spread up and down.
Bill Flanagan is my guest, and he's the author of the new novel, A&R, which is set in the record industry. He's also senior vice president and editorial director at VH1. Well, big record company labels are getting even bigger. Mega corporations are becoming even more mega now in the record industry. Seagram's bought Universal, and that shook up the record world. Now a French company, Vivendi, is buying Seagram's. What would this unite under one company if the deal goes through?
Well, I'll tell you what's astonishing about the Vivendi deal. I hope this isn't too high on his side, but I think it's kind of interesting. Last year, in January of 1999, the Seagram's deal went through, and it was, I can't tell you what convulsions it caused in the record industry, because what happened was Seagram's, the big liquor company, had already bought Polygram, which was a mega company itself. Polygram owned Motown and A&M and all these other great labels. Then Seagram's, already having absorbed Polygram, bought Universal, MCA, which aside from being a big film company and all kinds of other things, had another bunch of great labels, Geffen Records and Uni Records and MCA Records and all these different things. So suddenly, two companies that had already swallowed everything were swallowed by a bigger company. And many, many, many lifetime record executives were thrown out of work. And many, many terrific artists were dropped, people, because they weren't selling multi-millions. There wasn't any room for them anymore. So that was shocking enough. And that was sort of a period of a few weeks when layoff after layoff hit these people in their mid-40s and 50s who'd been in it forever, when they realized that the old record business was never coming back. Now, here's what's amazing. Cut to a year and a half later. And since then, AOL has bought Time Warner, which also bought EMI, which is Capitol Records and the Beatles and Frank Sinatra and everything, and made that one big company. The company I work for, Viacom, has absorbed CBS and all kinds of other stuff, and I'm really happy about that. I make a lot of dough. I don't want to be a hypocrite. But suddenly, a year and a half after the Seagram's deal rocked the music industry, the folks at Seagram's are saying, well, we can no longer compete in a world of AOL, Time Warner, EMI. We're not big enough. We don't have enough assets. All we have is music, pretty much. So therefore, Vivendi, a French company, which basically is in the water and power utilities business, I mean, they also make cell phones and a lot of other things, has come in as a white knight and absorbed Seagram's. So it is astonishing. I mean, Jonah would be amazed to see how many bigger and bigger leviathans can come and keep swallowing the next one and swallowing the next one and swallowing the next one. And I think what's most amazing is that the deal that was considered to be the most gigantic thing ever in the music industry in January of 1999, creating the ultimate super company that was going to plow over everything else in the road, had become, by June of 2000, something that was, well, we're not really big enough to compete against the new mega giant super leviathans that have sprung up in the last 12 months.
How do you think that the mega, mega, mega companies are changing what life is like for an artist who's signed to a major record label?
That's sort of the issue boiling in the background of A&R, because let me say something about the way that the record business was from the early 60s or the 50s until now, until a couple of years ago, until the late 90s. I'm not saying that the guys who ran the record companies, especially some of the small record companies, weren't sort of pirates and shady characters, because in many cases they were. They were signing people to terrible contracts. They were stealing the publishing. They were doing all the terrible things we've heard about. However, what I would say, if I were being devil's advocate, what I'd say in their defense is that they were in it for life, and they were music men. And you did know that if you shook hands with one of these guys, admittedly, you should put your wallet in your boot before you do, but if you shook hands with one of these guys in 1965, then he was still going to be there until they dragged his cold body away from the desk. He was going to be there forever. His company was going to be there forever. What that meant we had, that we've kind of lost in the record business, is that there was long-term security. There was a sense that you were making a deal with a company, and very often with an individual, who was going to be there for life. So, if it were Columbia Records in the early 60s, and you were Bob Dylan or Paul Simon, and you went in, then there was every expectation that if you sold a certain number of records, you were going to be with Columbia forever. And what it meant from Columbia's side was that they could afford to stick with you for a long time. Bob Dylan's first record sold nothing. Simon and Garfunkel's first record sold nothing. Bruce Springsteen's first record sold nothing. Billy Joel's first record sold nothing. In many cases, it wasn't till the third or fourth or fifth album that these guys started breaking through, till they even really started figuring out how to do what it was they were going to do so well. That was fine with the company. They were patient. They had them forever. That's completely disappeared. No one at a major record company now feels he has any job security. They're not even sure there are going to be record companies as we know them now in another 5 years. And with all the mergers, the layoffs, you don't know who your boss is going to be 6 months from now. So people are very, very desperate to get a hit as quick as possible. A, it'll keep them from being fired. I'm talking about the record executives now. But B, it's how they build their portfolio, with the expectation that they'll be changing jobs soon anyway. So the notion of, here's Neil Young, he's a little rough, he has kind of a funny voice, but he's got enormous talent, let's sign him because he's going to mean something over the next 10 years, is completely gone. It is now a matter of, get me somebody real good looking who can dance, and we'll get a bunch of hacks in here to come up with a catchy pop song, and we'll make a video, and we'll get it on MTV fast. And even if it's over in 6 months, I'll have made my $1 million. I'll have my kids' college fund covered. I'll have got my beach house. And then if the whole thing goes to hell, well, I'm taken care of. So there's no loyalty up, there's no loyalty down.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Flanagan. He's Senior Vice President and Editorial Director at VH1 and author of a new novel set in the record industry called A&R, as an artisan repertoire.
Also, it's in Assault and Robbery, as one of the characters points out. To a record person, A&R means artisan repertoire. To a cop, it means assault and robbery.
Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Flanagan, author of the new novel A&R, which is set in the record industry, and Senior Vice President and Editorial Director at VH1. As you've pointed out, for people who are signed to major labels, A&R doesn't mean artisan repertoire, it means assault and robbery. There are a bunch of recording artists now who had been signed or still are signed to major labels and have become disgusted with the kind of contracts that major labels offer. What are the typical complaints that you hear, the kind of complaints that are driving some major artists to leave major record companies?
The kind of contracts that have remained in force in the record industry would be laughed at in any comparable business. They'd be laughed at in the book business. They'd be laughed at in the movie business. For example, an artist working for a record company or signed to a record company has to pay all the costs of making the record and, in fact, doesn't see any money until all those costs are paid back out of his royalty. However, the record company owns the recording in perpetuity. The record company owns the recording even if they drop the artist and delete the recording. Now, if the sad day comes when Random House drops my book, then the rights to the book revert to me. And if I can find another publisher to bring it out, then I'll find the other publisher to bring it out. In a record company, if Bob Dylan lost his record deal tomorrow, Sony would always own all of Bob Dylan's recordings, even if they weren't releasing them. And that becomes a terrible thing for an artist because he says, look, I've got this little label over here that would be happy to put out my records. You're not even putting them out. Could I just put them out there? And the answer is no. No, you can't. We own them. Hey, maybe you'll die in a plane crash and then they'll be worth something to us. And that's just one example. There's all kinds of stuff. As I get into in the novel, there are things that even the lawyers themselves admit are ridiculous. Most major record companies will say to a young band coming in, we'd like you to use our lawyer as your lawyer. Now think about that. The lawyers who are on retainer for the record companies are also representing the artists. So, you know, guess who the deals are going to favor? They're going to favor the record companies. So a lot of artists, as they've gotten older and wiser and been robbed, have said, boy, this isn't for me. But no one's been very successful in getting any of the major labels to change the basic way they operate. I mean, I suppose if you're Michael Jackson, you can go in and negotiate a better deal for yourself. But to sort of change those fundamentals of ownership, it's why Prince wrote Slave on his face and walked around like that for a couple of years. It was the realization that, wait, I'm paying for everything, I'm creating everything, and they own it all, and I can never, ever get it back.
On the one hand, you have these huge mega companies that are being accused of cutting really unfavorable deals with the artists. Deals unfavorable to the artists. On the other hand, these mega companies are feeling very threatened now by the internet. What are the greatest threats to the record companies now posed by the internet?
Well, the reason that it's a very interesting moment. The reason that the record companies have been able to impose these very unfavorable conditions on musicians is that basically the record companies own the pressing plants and the trucks. And that meant that they could say, we take 95% and you could take 5% after you've paid back all our costs, which you never will. Because just to get a record to the store in the United States, just to make sure that every Kmart in Oklahoma and every mom and pop store, along the Canadian border has it, is an enormous undertaking. And until very recently, there was no way to get around the fact. And many artists tried. As early as the 70s, the Grateful Dead tried to set up their own label with their own pressing plant and their own distribution. They just couldn't get the records to the stores. So just a few people, 7 at the beginning of the 90s and down to 4, I think, now, had all the control because they had the pressing plants, they had the trucks, they had the relations with the big distributors. Often they owned the big distributors. What's so astonishing about the web, the internet, computers, is that suddenly you don't need a pressing plant and you don't need a truck to get into the music distribution business. Suddenly a kid in his bedroom can do it, can theoretically do it. This has caused an earthquake in the record business that started building about 1992. And more I'd hear record executives go, well, I think it'll be 2010 before they can pull it off, and I'll have my money and I'll be out of the business by then. It's what contributed to the general atmosphere of I've got to make a quick hit and get out of here because I don't know if it'll exist soon. And what's happened with Napster and MP3 is that it's been demonstrated that there are perhaps millions of people already anxious and, in fact, going out downloading music from the web. It's not a theoretical anymore, and it's gone from the record stores being concerned that they were going to be cut out a few years ago to now the record labels being scared that they're going to cut out. Because really, if you're REM, if you're U2, if you're Madonna, what do you need a record company for? Well, right now, people say, well, they still need them for marketing. Well, you could hire freelance marketing people. There's already a bit of people who have been laid off in the great record company mergers going out and starting freelance marketing companies saying, hire me for 6 months, I'll do your ad campaign, I'll make sure that the presence is out there, we'll book the billboards, and just pay me a fee. So we're entering a whole new world. The guys have had the gun to the artist's head forever because they own the trucks, and suddenly the trucks don't matter.
The RIAA, the Recording Industry Association of America, which is a lobbying group representing the major record labels, won a lawsuit against MP3. What did they win?
Well, that's perfectly fair. The RIAA has won, legitimately, I think, a lawsuit saying that you can't take our product and make it available to people without paying us a royalty for it. See, the only impediment right now to individual artists and labels turning the music industry entirely into a web-driven industry is that nobody's figured out how to get the money out. But that's kind of a matter of engineering. We can't be that far away from the day when you'll hit the button for the record you want and something will appear on your phone bill or you stick in your credit card number. That day hasn't arrived yet. It's a funny thing where the technology to deliver the product has arrived before the technology to get paid for delivering the product. So whether it's record companies or whether it's individual artists setting up their own distribution systems, there does have to be a way for people to get paid for the product.
Bill Flanagan is the author of a new novel set in the music industry called A&R. He's also Senior Vice President and Editorial Director of VH1. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bill Flanagan, author of the new novel A&R, which is set in the music industry. It's about an idealistic talent scout who leaves an independent record label to become head of artisan repertoire at a conglomerate. Flanagan is also senior vice president and editorial director at VH1. It seems that rock music has become so fragmented. There are so many different subdivisions within pop music now. What are some of them that, some of them beyond the obvious ones that you feel you have to keep up with?
Well, one of the things that I think is interesting about the moment we're in, and it's one of the things going on just under the surface of what's happening in A&R, is that we have, since Elvis Presley, certainly since the Beatles, been in a world where rock music was the basis of pop music. And that's sort of changing. I mean, hip-hop is really the basis for pop music now. If you turn on a top 40 station, most of what you hear comes out of rap and hip-hop and other modern black studio-created music. So rock's kind of going into its decline. I hate to say it because I love it, and I think that people my age, baby boomers, are going to always, we're going to carry it right through the python with us. But the fact is, it's not the center anymore. So you have an era that came to its full fruition with the Beatles and Bob Dylan and continued to keep replenishing itself through probably Nirvana in the mid-90s, finally being shoved out of the way. And that's another thing that's very hard for a whole generation of record executives to understand. See, the great old record executives, the great old assembly line guys like Mitch Miller, were pushed aside by the rise of rock. And now finally, as the baby boomers go into their 50s, they're being pushed aside by something new. I suppose it's inevitable, but it doesn't make it any less sad.
Do you find it very difficult to keep up with all the music coming out now?
One of the hardest things, I think, if you work in the music business, to do is to protect your own love of music. And it's absolutely crucial. It's the only thing that makes it worth doing. Otherwise, you might as well be selling shoes. So I really try to not try to stay on top of everything. I mean, obviously, I work at VH1. I'm in the middle of it. I get boxes of records for free every day. I get to go into every club in New York for free every night. So I see an awful lot of music. I hear an awful lot of music, and I know a lot more about what's going on than a civilian would. At the same time, I don't put any pressure on myself to feel I have to know everything about something just because it's trendy at the moment. Because what happens then is it starts to become product to you. It all starts to become the same thing. And I can get really excited when I find a new group. There's a Scottish group called Travis that I think could be the next U2. They're just tremendous. They've got great melodies, great songs. And I went to see them play at a club here in New York recently. And not only was the club packed to the rafters, but everybody in the audience knew the words to every song. That the fact that you can hear something like that. There's a guy who has a record out on Rykodisc, a fellow named Peter Bruntnell. I don't know anything about him. Apparently he's English. It's one of the most beautiful records I've heard in years. I don't even know what the guy looks like, but I play it over and over again. So I think what you want to do just to kind of keep your heart in it is is to make sure that you cultivate the best part of yourself, the part of yourself that loves music, and you try not to be up on everything. You can't be up on everything.
I'm interested in how much time you spend in record stores and also in how you're using the internet now for music.
I do spend quite a lot of time in record stores because I like them. I worked in record stores for years when I was a kid, and I still like going in and trying to find something that I didn't know about or I haven't seen, or some old record that I loved that's just become available on an import CD or something. I'm also in the very fortunate position of having almost every record that's released sent to me for free. I've actually been in that fortunate position for 20 years, so I don't have to go, but I like to go. And you know, I'll find an excuse to go. I'll go looking for non-LP B-sides from England or something. It's something I've always enjoyed.
I don't
use the internet at all. I don't go on. I don't even read what people are saying about me because and I'm sure I would if I lived in Maine or something, if I were a little more on the outskirts, then I think I would take advantage of it. My kids take tremendous advantage of it. But I kind of feel like I have so much stuff coming at me all the time. I have so much mail I haven't opened. I have so many phone messages I haven't returned. I have so many people writing me and emailing me and trying to get my attention that the notion of any more input sort of would probably make smoke come out of my ears and I'd fall over in a heap. And there is something that, much as I completely appreciate the internet and I love what it means, personally, I don't need to know that much. You know, I just feel like my head's overstuffed anyway. And I find it a little bit... There's a scene in the novel where a great old rock star is shown at home just trolling all his websites and sort of eavesdropping on what his fans are saying about him and kind of disappearing up his own rear end. And I don't think we need to know that much, to tell you the truth.
Now, you created, I believe you created two of the shows on VH1, Legends and Storytellers.
Yeah, I take the credit for creating them. A lot of people were involved, but yes, I'll take the credit for
that. Okay. How did you and the people you're working with come up with the ideas for the shows?
Legends was a pretty obvious one. We wanted to be able to tell the whole life story of great musicians and explain where the music came from in kind of a Ken Burns Civil War approach. And that's what it began as, and although it's evolved a little bit, that's pretty much what it continues to be. Behind the Music, which is actually a more successful show, spun out of that because Jeff Gaspin, who's the head of production and a real creative guy, said, you know, there's a lot more good stories among the people who are not legends than there are among the legends. So that begat that. Storytellers, which is a show in which great singer-songwriters from all genres talk about how they wrote their songs and then play them for a very small audience, really came out of the notion of, gee, rock music doesn't seem to work very well on TV. When you go to Madison Square Garden and you see a big star with lights and lasers and mountains of amplifiers and he's making grand gestures, it's really exciting. It's really compelling. We are there at the Church of Rock and Roll, worshiping with our brothers and sisters, standing on our chairs. And yet, when I see that same performance on television, it seems overblown and pompous and kind of ridiculous. The sound isn't very good. You can't hear the bass and drums anymore. The grand gestures just look silly. And the effect of the lights and the smoke and all the other visual things going on is to just look kind of foggy and confused. So basically the notion was, we don't do that well on TV. Maybe we shouldn't do it, which immediately led to, well, what can TV do that you could never do in Madison Square Garden? And the answer was intimacy, direct communication. And we thought that if we could come up with a format in which musicians sat and talked directly to the camera, talked directly to the person sitting home on the couch about where the songs came from, and then played those songs, sort of the shed the light on them, told you the story, got you hooked, and then played them, that would be good television. And it would be something that you could not get anywhere else. And that's what Storytellers came out of. At first, we weren't even going to have a studio audience for Storytellers, but we realized that it's an awful lot easier for the musician to loosen up and be at his best if he's actually looking someone in the eye and talking to them. So we decided to bring in 100, 150 people and have them sit around the musician almost as if it were a party and let him talk directly. So when he's looking into the eye of the audience sitting 3 feet away from him, the camera picks it up as he's looking into the eye of the viewer.
Now, you mentioned that your show Legends led to Behind the Music. Yeah. And, you know, Behind the Music is, it's funny in a way because, you know, some of the bands that are profiled on there have gone through these, like, miserable experiences of, like, drug habits and death of band members. And
Car crashes, overdoses, multiple divorces.
Accountants who fleece them from all of their profits.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm wondering if bands ever come to VH1 and say, we've had a lot of misery in our background. Can you do a show on us?
We have lots of nightmares to share. People come in with the parade of brutalities.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
I should get a Behind the Music. We go, oh, I don't know, man. You know, I'm not sure everybody really remembers, you know, the flying mushroom. They go, let me tell you something. Three of our band members died. There was actually a pitch. Which, I mean, I want to be careful to disguise this. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But there was a pitch which began with, two of our band members committed suicide. How's that?
Right. That's bizarre when you get pitched that way, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it's the nature of television in the year 2000. I'm sure it's nothing compared to what Jerry Springer hears.
Well, Bill Flanagan, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, it's been great, Terry. I really enjoyed it.
Bill Flanagan is the author of a new novel set in the music industry called A&R. He's editorial director of VH1, where he created the shows Storytellers and Legends. Here's David Bowie performing on Storytellers.
Just a wreck without me. Little China girl, I hear her heart beating. It's loud as thunder. I saw the stars crashing.